Peace Talks, a forum for peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution within ourselves, our families, our neighborhoods, our country, our world. Mother Teresa said, "If there is no peace in the world today, it's because there's no peace in the family. Help your families to become centers of compassion and forgive constantly, and so bring peace." Today on Peace Talks, Peaceful Parenting.
Welcome to Peace Talks. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Today, peaceful parenting. When parents and children disagree, conflict can escalate rapidly, and we say things we often regret later. Some feel that by learning to express our feelings through words, family members can de-escalate arguments and begin to listen to one another. Today on Peace Talks, we'll hear from someone who will help us explore ways for parents to learn and to teach their children how to resolve conflict more effectively by expressing feelings. Our guest is Dr. Victor Lacerva, a physician who has worked in violence prevention for more than 12 years. Currently, he's a medical director of the New Mexico Department of Health's Family Health Bureau and holds a clinical faculty appointment with the Department of Pediatrics at the University of New Mexico Medical School. He's written several books on violence prevention, including Let Peace Begin With Us. His second book, Pathways to Peace, 40 Steps to a Less Violent America. And most recently, World Words, Global Reflections to Awake the Spirit. Most importantly, Victor has two daughters who, as he describes it, teach me what I most need to know about raising children in a violent world. Welcome, Victor.
Pleasure to be here, Suzanne.
Let's start with a story from your life or your work about peaceful parenting.
Well, one of the stories that comes to mind was it was shortly after my wife, the mother of my children, and I had separated, and we were living in a very small apartment. And it was one of those cloudy, rainy days where everybody was getting on everybody. And I remember that my two girls, who were about 4 years apart, were really getting into it in terms of not being so nice with each other. And finally, the little one just whacked the older one as a way to break the tension and get it to stop. And I remember grabbing her in a fairly rough manner and pushing her down on the bed and saying, "We are not a hitting family." Of course, modeling totally the opposite behavior. So that was an example of not being really in touch with my feelings in the best way possible. So the whole notion of emotional fluency, I think, is an essential one for parents to understand.
So talk about emotional fluency and how you could have used that, for example, with your younger daughter instead of grabbing her.
Well, emotional fluency is kind of a developmental process, in a sense, in terms of the first principle that we need to understand is that we are teaching our children all the time, even if we're not consciously doing it. So the way that we deal with our basic emotions of mad, sad, glad, and afraid, we model those behaviors, and they begin to think that that's what's normal, that that's how you deal with anger. If in the family that you grew up in, people hit each other or hurt each other a lot when they were angry, then you begin to think that's how everybody acts. If in the family that you grew up in, your parents stuffed their anger and so they never expressed it, but there was always this tension that was almost palpable, then that's what you begin to think is normal. So in that particular moment in my own situation, I was not in touch with my own anger and irritability and therefore was not skillful enough to do something to defuse it, and so basically took it out on my kids. Now, what I did do afterwards pretty quickly was model forgiveness, which is another piece of emotional fluency, when we say we're sorry when we mess up. And it only took me a few minutes to realize that I had acted inappropriately and then asked for my child's forgiveness.
So fluency is a term that we use with different kinds of language, fluent in English, Spanish, French. How can we become fluent with emotions?
Well, again, it's a developmental process. So if we think of it from the beginning, babies and children kind of learn with their whole bodies. You know, if you watch a baby and you talk to a baby, you will see this almost Tai Chi slow movement that they have with their entire body as they're absorbing and learning the language. And so babies respond very much to tone of voice, because that is essentially what's being transmitted to them. So if you say, "Oh, you're such an ugly baby," and the baby will be smiling back at you because they're responding to that softness that's in your voice. So emotional fluency, in a sense, begins with that bond of trust that develops between a baby and other human beings. what happens next is, as babies begin to get to the place where they're becoming verbal, is we need to teach them a word for the experience they're having in their body. Sure is frustrating, Juan, when those blocks don't stay where you want, as Juan, at age 2.5, is flinging the blocks all over the playroom because he's upset that his tower didn't stay up. Or kind of scary up there on the slide, isn't it, Mario? But exciting at the same time as Mario is looking down this big thing trying to decide whether he really wants to slide down. So we give them a word for what they're experiencing in their body. Between the ages of 3 and 5, and even better if we can do it in more than one language, we give them a lot of words to express the continuum of feelings. So I'm annoyed, I'm irritated, I'm bugged, I'm peeved, I'm mad, I'm angry, I'm raging, I'm really upset. We give them lots of different words so they can express the varying hues of a given specific emotion.
But some adults don't have that much fluency themselves. So what about for our listeners who really don't have a wide range of emotional fluency? What do you recommend for them to get started?
Well, I think part of it is to just become in touch with some very basic notions. The first basic notion I would say is that all feelings are okay, all behaviors are not. For example, I could have skillfully said with my two children, it's fine for you to be mad at your sister, find another way of expressing that feeling than hitting her. The second thing I think is to begin to reflect on our own use of the language. When we yell at our child and say, you stupid jerk, you spilled the milk again, that has a real different flavor than I feel upset that the milk got spilled when I asked you to move the glass in from the edge of the table and you chose to ignore me. Let's clean it up because we need to get out of here. We need to get the morning scene going or whatever. Real different feel when we use that I feel followed by an emotion word. Whenever you use you, you put the other person on the defensive. They feel attacked and so on. If you start it with just I feel upset. I feel scared. A typical example would be the toddler who gets lost in the grocery store or in Walmart. And you see this reaction all the time. The first reaction of the parents is angry. You know, where were you? Don't you do that? Don't you ever do that? Blah, blah, blah. What's really going on was, gee, I was scared. I was afraid something happened to you.
Okay, so let's slow that down. How do parents recognize that they're really angry? And what do they do right in that moment?
Okay, well, we will notice in our bodies that there's a change in our bodies because, for example, with anger, it's based on the fight or flight response. There's this hormonal cocktail in our bodies where our energy gets escalated. Our pulse goes up, our pupils dilate, the blood goes to the big muscles of our system to prepare us to run away or to fight. So we can notice those changes. To notice where we first hold that tension. For some people, it's the back of their neck. For some people, it's their stomach. For me, it's my jaw. I know that when my jaw starts to get tight, that's a signal to me that that my anger meter, if you will, is beginning to move from not angry at all to being bugged, annoyed, irritated. And I want to stop it as early in that cycle, or I want to deal with it, be a better way. I want to dance with it as early in that cycle as possible because it's easier then to take a deep breath. Or sometimes the most skillful thing to do is to do something to improve the physiology. Gee, everybody's hungry. Let's take a bite to eat. Or on the weekend, I'll tell my girls, hey, Dad, I'm getting cranky. I need my power nap. And they'll say, go for it, Dad, go for it. You know, because they know that if I get that 20 minutes by myself to just chill out, even when they were younger, that I'd be in a much better place emotionally. So that's the first piece. The second thing is that you can develop a signal in the family. We didn't do it all the time, but we used to use just the feedback of tone. Because one of the things besides the changes in the body that happens is the tone of voice changes. So anybody had permission to use tone. Actually, my younger daughter, who's a bit of an entrepreneur, had me paying her a quarter for every time she had to say tone to me. And it could just be a nasty thing like, come on, Rosa, get your coat. Just that nasty edge to my voice. But I was trying to work on that. And so she'd say, geez, Dad, tone, that's 50 cents so far this morning, you know, like that. It was a way of lightening it up, but it also reflected the value that we had or that we were trying to create in the family, which is that we treat each other with loving kindness and respect as much as possible. So you don't have to go into a big, long story. Anybody can say tone to each other. Like I say, it doesn't work. None of this stuff works all the time. But it's a way to to have a little fun with it.
This is Peace Talks, and we're talking about peaceful parenting with Victor Lacerva, medical director of the Family Health Bureau for the New Mexico Department of Health. On each Peace Talks program, we'll be inviting other folks from the community to participate. In a few minutes, parent Sarah Malone and her teenage son Kevin will join us. Victor, let's talk about spanking, because the story you told about your younger daughter, when you grabbed her, some parents would have just spanked her. A recent child development survey found that 61% of the adults who responded actually condoned spanking as a regular form of punishment. And I think a lot of parents think, well, you know, I was spanked, it didn't kill me, I'm going to spank my kids, it works.
The first thing is to distinguish what we mean by spanking, because spanking is a term that lots of people use. But obviously there's a difference between an open hand swat on a diaper twice a week to dad every night when he comes home taking his belt out and punishing the kids for all the infractions that occurred in the course of the day. We would call both of those things spanking in a sense, but there's obviously a clear difference. So the first thing we need to establish is what exactly are we talking about in terms of the amount and the frequency and so on. The second thing is I've done a lot of work with families embroiled in family violence, domestic violence, and it's quite clear to me that the power and control dynamics that exist in domestic violence are very similar in the spanking scenario. I'm bigger and stronger than you. I think that you should do what I tell you to do, and I have the right to use physical force to make you do it. The third piece is that discipline comes from a Latin root, which means to understand by taking apart. So it involves an element of teaching. What we're really trying to do with our kids is teach them and guide them to have good values, to be good human beings. When we spank them, essentially what we teach them, because most of the time this is the reality, is that when adults are out of control and have a temper tantrum, it's okay for them to lash out at someone who's weak and vulnerable. We also teach them that the people who love you are the ones who hurt you. We don't teach them anything about how to behave when we spend so much time in the punishment mode. So there's a lot of reasons why, for me personally, spanking doesn't make sense. But what I tell people who have young children, when I ask them about how do they discipline their children, and they tell me that they spank their kids, once I ascertain where we are on that continuum, I say, well, let's make a deal. Let's try for a couple of months to change something so that you're not going to hit your kids when you're angry, and then see how often you really feel the need to hit your kids. Because, again, the evidence tells us that most of the time when parents are spanking their kids, it's not about trying to teach them anything. It's really about the parent having a temper tantrum or feeling like that's the only tool that they have in their toolbox. So that's another thing I say to parents. If you really feel after we do this couple of months trial that you really want to hit your kids as a way to teach them, then let's not have it be the only tool in your toolbox. And then that opens up the possibility for other discussion around positive discipline, you know, stars on the refrigerator, when they catch them when they're being right would be kind of the soundbite take-home message instead of always focusing when they're doing wrong.
Let me give you a difficult situation to respond to. Most of us have been in this situation. You're in a store or you're in a parking lot. You hear a child scream and you turn and you see a parent hitting or harming their child. What do you do in that situation?
The first is that you need to be able to approach that individual if you choose to intervene in a calm, centered manner. You have to keep your own center. If you're going to go over there and yell at this person, then you're going to just be generating more hostility and more negativity and more violence in the world, essentially. The second, the B, is to blend with the frustration that the parent is having in that moment. Gee, I remember when my kids were that age, it was so frustrating to try and get anything done. Or something like that. I remember how exhausted I was all the time trying to take the kids grocery shopping was a horror show. Somehow you blend, you acknowledge why that parent at that particular moment is not at their personal best. Then the C is you offer the possibility of change. You say, what I used to do was, you know that junk food they always want you to buy at the end? Well, you buy it at the beginning and then they can be eating it while you're doing your shopping. Or I used to take out a little toy for each aisle in the supermarket so they'd stay entertained. And then the D is to offer to actually do something concrete. If I'm with my kids, I will say, would you like us to watch the baby for a little bit? We can play with the baby for a while you finish up your shopping. Or do you have some things on your list that I can get for you? And my experience, having done this dozens of times, is that most people will refuse the offer of help at that particular moment. But you've already changed the dynamics of what's happening just by your being that kind presence.
But has it happened, or I'm sure it does happen, where the person just refuses? You're into the bee trying to blend, and they're saying, mind your own business.
That actually has never happened to me. Well, one time in Disneyland, at the end of the day, when everybody was exhausted and you could see these families scattered about trying to hold on for the fireworks that are going to happen at the end of the day, and this one guy was you know, just short of whacking his toddler. I mean, the kid was screaming and holding onto his leg, and I tried all my usual stuff, and he just stonewalled me, just gave me this fairly hostile look. But actually just walking over to him altered the situation, because then the mother picked the kid up. She already had another kid in one arm, but she picked the other kid up.
We're joined in the studio today by Sarah Malone, who is a school social worker and a mother, and her son Kevin, who is a senior at Sandia Prep. So you've been listening to Victor. What questions do either of you have for him?
Okay, I have a quick question. What about more of a friendship style with your parents? I don't know, sometimes I have a really close relationship with, like, my mom and my dad, and we're just talking about our lives in general, and it really reminds me of the relationship I would have with an older friend, and I just am wondering whether that would work with other situations other than myself.
Does it work for you? How does it feel when that's happening?
It feels good for that situation, but I know that sometimes it can't work when my perspective of what I need to do is different than theirs.
Okay, let me try and answer it a different way. The longest longitudinal study that we have about adolescents and how they do in the world and how they get through that difficult rite of transition, one piece of what we learned from that study, which is ongoing, is that there are two essential qualities that if the parents exhibit those qualities, those kids do much better. So those are a high sense of caring and support, the kind of conversations that you're describing, and a high sense of monitoring. Where you going? Who you going with? Gee, you've been hanging out with this person a lot. I'd like to meet them, or I'd like to meet their family, like that. Kids who do the worst in terms of their transition through adolescence into adulthood are when both of those qualities are lacking. Kids who do kind of in the middle are when you get that real disciplinary dad, you know, with the strict curfew, but there is no sense of warmth and caring. And the kids who also don't do as well are the kind of hippie parents. Yeah, it's cool. We trust you. We'll see you. You know, whenever you come home is fine. That those kids also don't do as well.
The Osbournes.
Yeah. So the notion here is that there's a balance with that, Kevin, like with anything. And those moments are beautiful. I treasure those conversations that I have with my own daughter. But I've got to, besides that caring and warmth piece, I've also got to have that monitoring piece. And sometimes that's what the teens will rebel against, because they want to have their freedom.
Well, I chime in here and say, first of all, this has been a really interesting conversation, not only as a parent, but also as a school social worker. I'm remembering when Kevin was very young and he was going to school in a rural district where there were kids that were fairly aggressive on the playground, and we told him that it was not okay. He was not given permission to fight physically. And I don't know that we gave him a lot of tools about what to do instead. And I know he was in a fair number of headlocks on a regular basis, but he, and you could ask him this later, Gig developed a very interesting coping style of his own that I was really impressed by. But just as recently as the last month, teaching bullyproofing in a classroom of third graders, a student told me and the rest of the class that his father had told him that if somebody were to hit him, he was to hit the kid back, and that if he didn't, the father would take care of that when he got home and beat him up, basically. And another said that if he got a write-up for fighting, his dad would take him out to dinner as a reward. So I guess as both a parent and a professional, my question in part is, how do we work through parent biases in a very violently prone culture where parents say, basically, it worked for me, that's the way I was raised? Our culture doesn't really support much an alternative view, particularly for boys.
Well, there's a lot of questions embedded in that one question, but let me just say that it's a slow process to change social norms. And sort of the quick response to that is that there are a number of fight, flow, and flee strategies. And when I say fight strategies, I don't necessarily mean physical fighting strategies. There are fight-back strategies whereby you tell the teacher, whereby you learn some one-liner. Sure, you can have my lunch, but, you know, my mom had real bad diarrhea when she was making it this morning, or some other kind of a comeback line. The other thing that this brings up, though, is a piece of emotional fluency, and that is the check-in. It's a great habit to get into as a parent when your children are younger. What was the best part of your day? What was the worst part of your day or the most challenging part of your day? What was the best part of the soccer game? What was the most challenging part of the soccer game? What was the best part of the party? You can vary it up so it's not boring for either of you. But what you do with that simple practice is you get a snapshot of your child's emotional life. And at the same time, when you share the ups and downs of your life, what you're communicating to them is that we all have ups and downs. That's normal. And the way we get through it is by talking about it with each other. That was how I found out both of my kids were being bullied, because I was in the worst part of my day was Mario took my lunch again. So then we got to talk about, well, what do you think life is like in Mario's family? We started to pack extra lunch for Mario so she could offer him food before he demanded it, which was an interesting shift blend that changed the dynamics quite a bit. We told the teacher what was happening. So we kind of marshaled a bunch of strategies to try and deal with that situation. But I don't know that I would have found out about it had I not been in the habit of doing this emotional check-in.
I think that's an interesting comment, too, because once you've made the decision, I'm not going to use physical or verbal aggression, you find other strategies. In fact, I even had Kevin come to the classroom the year before last to talk about strategies that he developed, and the kids found it really hard to believe that he had never hit another student.
So, Kevin, I'm really curious. What are some of the strategies that you developed? Tell us some stories.
Well, I went to a rural elementary school where basically the only way you gained popularity was through physical combat and prevailing. I basically just found that anger towards my classmates, over time I realized that it wasn't constructive. So basically I began to understand when I was angry and just shut it down immediately.
A little bit of Star Trek shields up and open a channel, which is always, Star Trek Enterprise, when they encounter a hostile alien presence, they raise their shields in some way. I actually use this as a technique when I work with young men in the schools. Something that helps you keep your own center, because what someone wants more than anything is to get you off center, and then they've already won because they got what they wanted. So shields up, open a channel. I protect myself, but I'm also curious about where is this person coming from? What are they really trying to do?
Maybe you could share, Kevin, something about the strategy you used about finding a place of bonding or joining with another student, like, where'd you get those shoes? Or I think you were telling some of the students in my class about that.
I began to realize that the people who were trying to offend me and trying to get me angry at them, it wasn't that they didn't like me or that they were offended by who I was. It was that they actually wanted to be my friend, I guess. It wasn't that they were, like, envious or anything. It was just that they were uncomfortable about me for some reason. And if I could dispense with that uncomfort in our relationship, I found that we could actually become friends as opposed to enemies.
We're coming to the end of our program. Victor, if you had only 1 minute with every parent in America, what would your recommendation be for raising peaceful children?
Well, first of all, to find that place of peace within themselves and do what they need to do to improve their own emotional fluency and deal with their own stress so they can be good role models. That would be the first thing. Second thing is to realize that parenting really is a job that cannot be done alone, that we have to do it ourselves, but we can't do it alone, and that we need the support and assistance of other kind, loving human beings to help us on the journey with our children. And part of our task is to hook up our children with those other caring, loving human beings. The third thing that I think would be important would be to really get in touch with what are the values that you're really trying to transmit to your child and keep them at the forefront of your consciousness. We used to put up a value a month on the refrigerator, you know, integrity, kindness, compassion, honesty, trust, as a way of focusing discussion on that within the family and pointing out examples. But more it was for me to just kind of keep that sense there of the lighthouse of where I was really headed in terms of what I'm trying to transmit to my children.
I want to ask each of you to briefly recommend two or three books, websites, or other resources that our listeners might look to for some more help on this topic.
There's a great website called BDI at Temperament, TEMPERAMENT.com. And it's like a newsletter that you can get for free. Each month, they'll pick a particular topic and deal with some very, very difficult situation. I always learn something when I read through that newsletter. In terms of books, for parents with young children, young babies, Touch Points by Barry Brazelton is a great book just in terms of setting a good tone early on with the connection between parents and their children. How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. By Maslisch is an old classic that still is just a great, great resource in terms of communication. I like Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Successful Families. And, of course, my own book, Pathways to Peace, has a huge chunk of it that's devoted to parenting issues.
I've just been reading, having heard about it on NPR, Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys by Dan Kinlan and Michael Thompson, both of whom are PhD therapists, I believe psychologists. And as the mother of a son, I've been really enjoying reading it. And it addresses very much the whole issue of emotional fluency.
Well, I don't have a particular book or movie to recommend, but I would say that I think that my parents, for instance, have not encountered or accepted much of the culture that I live in. So I think that all parents should, however distasteful it may be, watch or listen to a CD that goes along with the mainstream of youth today. Because if you don't understand what we are living and listening to, you can't relate to the choices we have to make.
Any suggestions?
I don't know. A lot of the mainstream teen movies today, like American Pie and that whole series, are definitely a good representation of teen life today.
We'll list those as well as some other materials and links for this program on our website, which is peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, written as one word, .com. I'd like to thank Dr. Victor Lacerva, Kevin Malone, and his mother, Sarah, for being our guests on the program today. Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows, Incorporated, and was recorded in the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque. Producer and engineer is Paul Ingalls. Music by John Mellencamp and Allie Adelman. Our next Peace Talks program will be Friday morning, February 28th at 8:30. Hope you can join us. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.
Bonus discussion.
The parents I know have a lot of guilt about not being perfect parents. And again, it seems like so many of us weren't taught emotional fluency. So we're trying to catch up. We're trying to develop some emotional intelligence. What do you tell parents who feel guilty about not being perfect parents? And how can they develop some compassion for themselves for this very difficult job?
Well, I think, you know, you basically said it all, is to have compassion for yourself, to forgive yourself when you screw up, to ask for forgiveness when you're kids, so that you're with your own children, so that you're modeling that. And I think it's a basic realization that whatever family constellation we grew up in, we all got gifts and we all got wounds. And part of the task of moving into adulthood for ourselves is to go back and learn how to celebrate the gifts and do whatever we need to do to heal some of that woundedness. You know, an easy way to get in touch with some of that is to think of one of your parents and just write at the top of the page, "I resent," and then just start kind of freehand writing. This is an exercise from a book called Making Peace with Your Parents, which I don't think is in print anymore. It was a book that came out about 15, 20 years ago. Now, it's not about sending this list FedEx to your parents once you write it, you know. It's really about you getting in touch with what you're still holding on to in terms of how you were parented. And I think that's an important part of the process so that we become more conscious in terms of what we pass on to our children. Now, I remember moments of listening to my daughter speak to her sister in the same nasty tone of voice that I could use with her. And it hurts, you know, because you see that not only you're transmitting all the good stuff, but you're transmitting some of that stuff as well.
Okay, I have a quick question. How do parents maintain control over particularly unruly children without any form of intimidation?
Well, I think it very much depends on the age of the child. Most of us as parents vacillate between dictator and doormat. You know, when we're in dictator mode, it's like we want to lecture, we want to demand, we want to punish, go to your room for the rest of your life. When we're in doormat mode, we kind of want to rescue, we want to explain, let's go to your room at your earliest convenience, dear, that kind of a thing. And where we really want to be, it seems to me, is in the realm of natural consequences. And natural consequences means that we only have a few rules in the house, and those rules have consequences when they're not followed. And I think where most folks get into trouble as parents is when the rules are not clear and the consequences are not clear and there's not what I call ruthless follow-up. Now, having said all that, there is a subset of young people who just have a very difficult temperament. And I think it behooves parents to learn a little bit about the whole notion of temperament. And when we talk about resources at the end, I will give a website that's particularly good for kids who are over that edge in terms of being very, very difficult to control. And there's a whole different subset of techniques that you need to use with those folks.
Thank you. And I have another question about the parent relationship situation. What about more of a friendship style with your parents? Do you think that works, or do you think that tends to lead to more problems?
Well, I think a couple of things. That as young people enter adolescence, part of their curve of emotional fluency is that they need to learn how to deal with the mood storms that come with the changes that occur in adolescence. So, for example, with my own daughters, you know, it would be like this thunderstorm of anger would roll in. She's mad. She's annoyed at everything. I'm the worst dad in the world. Parents don't understand her. School sucks. You name it. And this storm rolls in. And if I do a couple of things right, the storm, like any storm, will kind of roll out. And to try and reason with a person when they're in the midst of they're in a different part of their brain than the cognitive part of their brain. And so reasoning doesn't really help. You just kind of have to weather it out the way you weather out a storm. So what that means for the parent is, number one, don't take it personally. Just understand that right now this is what's happening. Number two, get back to those I messages that we talked about before. Number three, acknowledge where your son or daughter is at. It's fine for you to be angry at the world. Please take it into your room instead of spreading it around the living room. That kind of a thing. And then afterwards, to talk with them as a friend, as a mentor, as someone who's been through it, to help them begin to understand, well, when did this first come on? What are some things you might have done so that it didn't get so intense as a storm? Now, having said all that, I also believe that it's the job of parents, particularly when young people reach around age 10, if they haven't done it already, that they need to find 3 to 5 other caring adults who will say the same words out of their mouth about whatever it is, sex, drugs, curfew. But because it's not coming from the parent, the young person is more likely to hear it. Now, this used to happen more naturally when we had large extended families and so on. Some parts of New Mexico, it still happens. But for many of us, we have to recreate that system. So we need to have those 3 to 5 older caring adults who can step in when the communication breaks down between the parent and the adolescent. That's a very important part of our parenting job.
So, Sarah, I met you and Kevin at a peace issues workshop in Albuquerque recently, and I was really struck by the comments that each of you made that your family is unusual, that you do really have an emphasis on peacemaking. And then I'm also hearing Victor say that mood storms are just a part of adolescence. I know they're also a part of adulthood. So there must be some conflict in your family and with Kevin. And I'm curious if there are ever situations where you just have to bottom line it, you know, and say, Kevin, this is about your safety and you're going to do what I say.
Well, I think that that's a really tough issue and a really hard one for those of us that are parents of adolescents, because as they get toward 18 and going on toward college, it's very important, I think, to allow them to test their wings and so forth. But you're right. There are certain rules, so to speak, that we really pray and hope that he won't violate. For example, drinking and driving. I have a sister that was killed by a drunken driver. But Kevin seems himself to have really adopted that as his own rule. There have been some occasions in which he's done something that we really found, you know, unacceptable, and we tried to go with what Victor was talking about with natural consequences. Well, okay, no car for a week, or some kind of a response that would fit the crime, so to speak. But yeah, I think it's a really hard one, and particularly with adolescents, where the choices that they make can have long-term, life-altering consequences that you as a parent may be mopping up after immediately or in the long term. But then you have to have some faith and trust, too, that you've developed in your child enough presence of mind and character and morals and so forth that they will really ultimately make the right choices. But it's an act of faith every time they take the car keys and drive off that they're going to come back.
And sometimes it's not just the job of parents at that point. It's also the community response. There's huge initiatives now across the country to deal with the issue of young people and alcohol. And I remember when I was growing up, if a cop came by and he saw us drinking beers in the park or whatever, he'd say, I'm going to come back in a few minutes and those beers are going to be gone, right, guys? And he would come back. But there was no real consequence to what was illegal behavior and dangerous behavior. That's really beginning to shift now, I think, considerably. And I'll just tell one other story, which is an acquaintance of mine whose daughter was acting out, getting involved with drugs and alcohol, just kind of blowing off curfews, disappearing, really creating a lot of disruption. And he would share how he was frustrated, didn't know what to do. And I think that sort of tough love notion is a very important one. And we finally advised him that the next time that he got a call from the police station, that he didn't go down until the next morning. You know, let her spend the night in jail and experience some consequence from her actions, as opposed to the rescuing all the time. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you. It's very scary. Particularly in today's world, but I think it's more than just the parents. That's when you got to bring in those 3 to 5 other caring adults to help create a framework. Or that's when you need to have what some people call a carefrontation. Mm-hmm. You get a group of people who care about this young person, and they just clearly express that and express their worry and their concern about the path and the choices that they're making. That's much more effective than getting in their face and having screaming and yelling matches and door slamming and all the rest of that, which doesn't get us anywhere.
I think, you know, another thing as a parent is you're continually monitoring how responsible has your son or daughter been. And if the student or child has been pretty responsible, then you reward that responsibility with greater privileges. And it's when the two of them are not sort of in line with one another that you have to do fine-tuning and adjustment. And I think that doesn't take long for a student and a son or daughter to realize there is a link between the two. And it's sort of funny because we've told Kevin, well, if you don't follow the rules, then we're going to pull in the, you know, the strings and you're going to have less freedom. So it sort of is a no-brainer to follow the rules. And we've been really, really fortunate because by and large, he's been a really easy kid to raise.
So, Kevin, back to what Victor was saying about emotional fluency. Different generations speak different languages, right? Mm-hmm. So what tips do you have? It's kind of like you're having to interpret across this generation between your generation, your mom and dad's generation. What tips do you have for other young people listening to our show about how to communicate feelings with their parents?
Okay, well, I know that kids today, generally, I know that I feel this way sometimes. They feel that their world and our experience with our friends and with youth today is something completely alien and separate from anything that our parents can relate to, which makes it very difficult for us to try to explain what's going on to our parents. So we try to, from time to time, come up with a scenario that they can relate to more, which may or may not be the truth. And I think that kids today need to realize that their parents want to, because they love you, they want to relate to what you're going through. They want to understand your experience, and you should not worry about their response, because they are going to be shocked at what you experience every day, but they need to understand that before you can relate to them at all.
I would just add something quickly to that, if I may, and that is that when young people do begin to open up about some of what's happening in their lives, a lot of times we as parents want to get into fix-it mode, which in some ways actually then becomes a barrier to intimacy. So we need to be really careful about that, and sometimes all we need to do is say, oh, that's interesting, what else about that, or tell me more about that, and just keep inviting them, as opposed to, well, this is what I would do, or right away getting in there and trying to fix it. I've had my older daughter accuse me, well, Dad, you just listen so much, sometimes I feel like you're mediating me or something. You know, it's like sometimes whatever you're doing isn't right, but I think it's useful to or another example is, I remember once she was trying to figure out what to write this paper on, and I gave her a couple of – she said, that's a really good idea, Dad. Too bad it came from you, because now I can't use it, that kind of thing. So, but again, just that notion of stepping back and just getting into active listening mode, as Lily Tomlin says, listen with the intensity normally reserved for speaking, or listen as if there's a thief in the house. It's an active process of trying to just be present. And not get into fix-it mode, which can shut things down.
Yeah, I heard it.
Oh, sorry. And as a major fixer-upper, that's sort of one of my life roles, I think that going back to emotional fluency is a helpful reminder, because when a parent goes into that mode, what it really is about, I think, is trying to address their own anxiety or their own worry or their own fears and so forth. And so maybe generating a greater self-awareness as a parent about what are the things that make you really scared or nervous, so that you can back off and do the listening without feeling like you have to fix it.
I heard this distinction described as the roles of moving from manager to consultant, so that when a kid is born, we're really their manager. We're telling them what to do and where to go and how to do things. And then when they become around the range of 10 to 12, we're starting to shift and ask if they want to hire us as their consultant. So that by the time they're 18, 19, 20, we're really just there to offer advice when they ask for it.
Except I'm not sure that works if you haven't been doing some ground laying during their early years. And I came from a family where it was what Dad said, that was it, there was no discussion. So as a young woman, I didn't really get to a place where I was able to ask myself, what do I want for myself, what do I really need, until I was 29. And that's really unfortunate. So I think that if, as a child is growing up, there's that process of discussion and give and take and allowing the child to have an opinion and give some ideas, then by the time they are adolescents, they're ready to be able to make some of those choices and decisions, and you can be more of the consultant.